Yesterday, in the discussion on the 14th chapter of the Gita, we learned about the three gunas of Maya, Sattva, Raj, Tam. So we saw that God did not create good and evil, because good means the sattvic quality of Maya, evil or bad means the tamas quality of Maya, and all three of these qualities are eternal. Raj is in between sattva and tam. God never created sattva or raj or tam. All three are eternal qualities of Maya. Maya is eternal. It never began and it will never end. So its qualities are eternal. We also learn, we can apply this philosophy to understand that no person is inherently good or evil. Sometimes we say, oh, he's a good soul. Or we say, that person is evil. In fact, it's just a matter of which of those qualities is predominating more in that person's mind. So we learn that if we develop the sattva gun, raj and tam are suppressed. So then the positive qualities are going to be expressed in our personality. If we develop rajogun, then more selfish qualities, agitated, always worried and ambitious, those kind of qualities are going to be exhibited in our personality. And if we develop the tamogun, then we develop the evil quality within ourselves. But all three qualities already exist within the human mind, because the mind itself is mayic, so it inherently has those qualities. But those qualities are not within the soul, so the soul is not sattvic or rajas or tamas. Soul is divine. So although it's beyond the three qualities of Maya, yet it's bound by the three qualities of Maya, because soul has a mind, and that mind is mayic. So it's bound by sattva, raj, tam. Then a person can develop sattva gun even if they're evil, meaning they've developed the tamogun to such an extent they're doing many evil deeds in the world, harming others on purpose. That person can change and start developing the sattva gun in their mind. So a bad person can become good, and a good person can become bad. A sattvic person could start doing wrong things and having tamas thoughts that would develop the tamogun in their mind, and then they would become evil. So we've swung along this pendulum many times in our uncountable past lifetimes. We've been good, then we've become bad, we've become good again, we keep going back and forth. We've done all kinds of karma. So no one is only good or only evil. They have all the good and bad qualities inherent in their mind. It's a question of which one we choose to develop through our thinking and actions. Of course, after God realization, Shri Krishna told us yesterday that if we reach Him, and to do that we have to go beyond the three gunas of Maya, if we do that, then we become like Him. We also become guna-atit. So how to do this seems rather puzzling. Sounds good. Go beyond the three gunas of Maya and become a perfect personality like God. Become divine. Then you're absolutely beyond bad. You're even beyond material good. Divine means absolute good. Unlimited goodness. So if you want to attain that, you have to go beyond the three gunas of Maya. In other words, you have to reach God. But when the only things we have at our disposal to think or talk or experience or do anything are mayic, meaning our mind, our senses, and our body, then with those mayic things, how will we go beyond Maya? With those things that are made of the three gunas of Maya, how will we transcend the three gunas of Maya? In fact, it's impossible if we try to do it on our own. But Shri Krishna says there is one way. Mam chayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate. Sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. He says, only through avyabhicharini bhakti. He used the same term in the 13th chapter as well. This verse I just quoted is from the very end of the 14th chapter. He says you have to do bhakti, and that bhakti has to be single-minded, desiring only Him. If you do that, you become gunatit. You go beyond the three gunas of maya and brahma bhuyaya kalpate. You become just like God. See, God has three things in unlimited amount. Sat, Chit, Anand. That's how we define God in simple terms in our Hindu scriptures. Sat meaning divine existence, eternal divine life. Chit meaning divine knowledge. And Anand meaning bliss, divine happiness. He has all three in unlimited amount. So when a soul surrenders to Him through bhakti, that soul receives Sat in unlimited amount, Chit in unlimited amount, and Anand in unlimited amount. So we become just like Him. Bhogamatra samya lingaccha, Brahma Sutra says, in terms of what we get to experience and enjoy, we're equal to God. He gave us whatever bliss and knowledge He has, He gave it all to us. So to do that, we have to reach Him, we have to become gunatit, and in order to do that, we have to do avyabhicharini bhakti. Bhakti is something that many people practice, but we don't practice that. Avyabhicharini means anandya, without the mind going here and there. Many people practice bhakti, but for one thing, when they're practicing bhakti, there's one thing many, many people forget, which is that, first of all, bhakti is done with the mind. We do formalities of bhakti regularly, whether it may be arti, or chanting God's name, repeating mantras, doing paath of any scripture, visiting holy places and mandirs. These are all forms of bhakti, but they're the physical or external forms of bhakti. True bhakti is done from the mind. That's the first thing we have to remember. That when Shri Krishna says, you can reach me through bhakti, there's no other way. Then what kind of bhakti is He talking about? He's talking about the surrender of our mind. He's not talking about any physical formality. Listen to hundreds of recitations of Bhagavat and Ramayana. You'll never reach Krishna if you don't give your mind to Him. It's not our ears that need to get cleaned. It's our heart that needs to get cleaned. So those shloka of Bhagavat are entering our ear, but are they entering our heart? That's the question. Reciting, some people know the entire Gita by memory, and they recite it every day. But it's not our tongue or our voice that we need to purify. It's our heart. It's the philosophy of the Gita going in our heart. What is Sri Krishna saying to Arjuna? He's saying, surrender to me. So we're repeating those words. Maam ekam sharanam braja, maam ekam sharanam braja. Surrender to me, surrender to me. What is repeating those words going to do for us? We have to do what the words are saying. In other words, bhakti has to be done from the mind, from the heart. And if we're doing bhakti from the heart, it means we have to remember Sri Krishna. That's the internal bhakti, antaranga bhakti. Bahiranga bhakti, bahiranga sadhana, those are helpers. They're to help us remember God, the puja, the paath, whatever it may be. It's to help us do antaranga sadhana, which is simply remembering God. If our mind is desiring the world, then that's where our mind is surrendered. And if our mind is desiring Krishna, then it means our mind is getting attached to Him. It's becoming surrendered to Him. But it's a process. So how to do that? First of all, know that bhakti must be done with the mind. That's the first thing. Second of all, know that if we're doing bhakti with any worldly desire in our mind, that also is not called ananya bhakti or avyavicharini bhakti. Means our mind is still going here and there. It means we haven't even understood the goal yet. That is my goal to attain divine happiness that only Krishna can give me, or is my goal to attain more worldly happiness? The worldly happiness we're familiar with. It's always limited and temporary. Divine happiness is always unlimited and everlasting. So which do we want? We should ask Him for that thing we want. So if we're worshipping Him with this as the reason that, Krishna, I'm worshipping You because I want You to bless me with this material thing, help me in this way, then it means we're not truly doing His bhakti. We're still doing bhakti of the world because we're desiring the world. This is what He means. This is one of the things He means by ananyata or avyabhicharini bhakti. That our mind should be focused on Him only. Such bhakti purifies the heart. However much we desire Him, that much our heart gets purified. Desire is not a bad thing. It's a matter of where the desire is directed. If we're desiring the world, then what's happening? Then our mind is becoming more impure through those worldly desires. If we're desiring Krishna, such a desire in fact purifies the heart. That's the very form of bhakti. Desire is bhakti as long as you're desiring God. So in the 15th chapter, Krishna gives us more understanding of why we should desire Him over the world. There's really only two questions a soul needs to answer. That is, what do I want and how do I get it? If you understand that and implement it in your life, there's really nothing more to know. So in order to answer these questions, in the beginning of the 15th chapter, Shri Krishna starts with a metaphor. He says this whole world is a tree, calls it a pippal tree. But it's upside down. The roots are urdhvamula. The roots are pointing up, and the shakha, the branches, they're going down and then spreading everywhere. So an upside down tree. He says this tree is anadi, anant. It never began and it will never end. However, its existence is unstable. So what is he saying through all of this? The root means where does it come from? So it comes from God. So God is said to be up. Not literally. If you're looking for God's divine abode, you can keep going up and up and up for many, many light years if you want to. You still won't reach God's abode. So it's not physically up, but we say it's a higher plane because He is beyond Maya. So we say He's above Maya. Normally the higher thing is supreme and the lower thing is subservient. So Maya is Krishna's power, so we say Maya is under Krishna. Krishna is above Maya. And Krishna is supporting Maya. Maya can't create this world on its own. It's an energy, but it doesn't have a mind to know what to do. It's interesting that such a basic question is normally not considered by scientists who are wondering about the origin of the universe. They know that energy, if it exists today, must have always existed. So they understand that the energy that makes up this world has to be eternally existing. They also hypothesized that it wasn't always in this evolved form or unfolded form, that at one point it was in a subtle form, and then it expanded or evolved into this manifested form. But have they ever thought why? If it was in that form, that subtle form, does the mayic energy, has anyone seen any evidence that the energy of this world has any kind of capability to just decide, okay, I'm in a dormant phase right now, let me expand into the form of this universe? No, the energy of this world is lifeless and mindless. Living beings have a mind because there's a soul there, so they're alive. But just the energy of the world? No, it has no such mind. So it means someone had to initiate that process. That someone is God. He turns it on, you can say. Just like a TV, it's a good example. There's a mayic thing made of mayic energy. Can it turn itself on? No, it can't even do that. You have to, an intelligent being has to turn the TV on. So the supreme intelligence, the supreme divinity, he has to turn Maya on. He activates the mayic energy, and then it manifests in a gross form, this gross physical form that we see, whereas before it was in a dormant, subtle form, absolutely subtle. So he is the root. Maya can't do anything without him. He activates it, and he keeps it activated for as long as the universe exists, and then when he decides, the whole thing returns back into that seed or subtle form. Thus, the roots of this world, the karan, the cause of this world, is God himself. He's also omnipresent in this world. Then the branches come down, meaning of the every corner of this universe, every particle of this universe, it's all a manifestation of that mayic energy, and it's endless, it goes on forever, it spreads for unlimited length in every direction, there's no end to it, and there are uncountable souls and living beings living in this universe. So this is the pipal tree of the universe, which has its roots up in God, and the universe itself is under God. It's supported by God, it's permeated by God, and its very existence depends upon God. But he says this universe, the nature of the mayic energy, although the energy itself has existed forever, it is anadi, it never began, and it is anant, it will never be destroyed. Yet, its sthiti, its the situation in which it exists is always unstable. It's always cyclical. God manifests the universe by activating Maya. Eventually the universe dissolves, call it pralaya. Then God activates it again. So it's unstable. And even while it's in this manifested state, it's still unstable. Everything in the universe is constantly decaying. This harmonium is decaying as we speak. My body is decaying as we speak. Everything in the universe is unstable. The happiness we get from these things then will also be unstable. It makes sense. The very things that we're hoping to find happiness from, things that we can look at, we look at someone beautiful. Okay. So you're getting happiness by observing someone's beauty. How long will that beauty last? Might last a couple of decades, but eventually their beauty will fade. So then that happiness fades. But even your happiness of looking at that person doesn't even last a couple of decades. If I make you sit facing that person who you consider to be supremely beautiful, and you have to keep looking at them non-stop for minutes, hours. No, you won't even make it hours. You won't even make it 1 hour. You'll be tired of that, the most beautiful person in the world that you love the most, you'll be tired of looking at their face before the first hour is up. So this is just the nature of everything worldly. Even the happiness we get is unstable. We can't keep looking at the same thing and enjoying it. We get bored. It's the same in every part of this world, every field that we try to enjoy. So Shri Krishna is indicating that when the universe itself is unstable, no physical form can last forever. Nothing that you consider to be your own can remain your own forever. When your own body is not going to remain yours forever, then what else is going could possibly remain your own? Your body is not going with you. Everything else goes with you. Shri Krishna explains that later in the chapter, that your mind and senses and karma and everything goes with you, but your body stays behind. So when your body's staying behind, everything else stays. Your possessions, your bank account, your relations, the people that you're attached to, all of them stay and you go when you pass away. So everything has this nature of impermanence and instability in this world. This is just the inherent nature of the mayic energy. Thus, Shri Krishna is indicating, you have to look beyond Maya if you want stable happiness, real happiness. If something is real, if it's a fact, then it should not be conditional to our thinking even. I'll give you an example. Let's say, take a rose flower, sign of love, red rose. So let's say on Valentine's Day, you go to your office and there's a dozen red roses waiting for you on your desk. You think, oh, I have some secret admirer. Somebody loves me. Those roses are making you so happy. Then you read the card and you see, oh, it's your ex-wife or ex-husband. They sent that to mock you. That since I divorced you, you've been so unhappy, something like that. Then you take those roses, you don't want to see those roses for one more second, you slam them into the garbage, tell your assistant, get these out of here. So, we're recording this, so we need to, the flowers initially gave you happiness. Why? Is there happiness in that flower? Is there happiness in the rose flower? Substantially speaking. If there was, then even when you saw the card, they should have kept giving you happiness. But they started giving you unhappiness. So it means there must be unhappiness in the rose flower. No. There's neither unhappiness nor unhappiness in the rose flower. It's just a rose. According to our thinking, we got happiness from it when we thought someone was admiring us, and we got unhappiness from it when we felt that someone was mocking us through those very same roses. So, real happiness has to be a substantial fact. It should be experienced in a stable way, and it should be able to be experienced by everyone in the same amount all the time. Take a person. Does one person give the same amount of happiness to everybody all the time? No. They don't even give the same amount of happiness to one person all the time. Again, take someone that you love. You spend time with them. Sometimes they're giving you more happiness, so you feel more love for them. Sometimes they're giving you less happiness, so you feel less love for them. Sometimes they're really acting in a disagreeable way, so they're making you unhappy. So that person is not even providing a stable amount of happiness to you. Then when you add other people, you could say maybe you're married to that person. So you're the wife or you're the husband, and maybe you have a child also. So that mother or father is going to give a different amount of happiness to their child than to their spouse. Then they also have a friend. The friend also gets some happiness from them, but it's going to be a different amount. Maybe they have a neighbor who's just a casual acquaintance. They may get a little bit of happiness or maybe nothing at all. They may have some enemies as well. People, colleagues, competitors that don't like them. So when that person sees them, they feel unhappy. Again, look at the situation. One person, everybody's experiencing a different amount of happiness from them. Some people are even getting unhappiness from the very same person. So it means that it can't be said that there's happiness in the person. If there is, you should be able to measure it, and it should be constant. You could say there's a 5 out of 10 units of happiness in this person. So then everyone would agree. Oh yes, see, just like water is wet, right? It's a fact. Water's wet. You pour it on your head, you get wet. That's what it is. That's one of its characteristics. It's a substance that has that characteristic. So if happiness were an actual substance which resided in a person or in a flower or in food or anything, then everybody should be able to agree on that characteristic. But we don't. Because the happiness we get from the people or the things of this world depends wholly upon our thinking, wholly upon our attachment to that person. The wife is more attached to the husband, so she gets more happiness when the husband is behaving favorably towards her. If the same husband is behaving favorably towards the neighbor doesn't really care, right? It's just a casual acquaintance. Okay, so he seems like a nice guy. It doesn't make him very happy. Maybe half a unit of happiness out of 10, whereas the wife is getting 9 out of 10. So nobody can agree, because it all depends on your thinking, how much attachment you have to that person. When, let's say, your son or daughter was away at college for a whole year, and they come back, so you throw them a welcome home party. You feel so happy seeing them come back. You are ecstatic. You haven't felt this happy in years, meeting your child after their first successful year at college. You invited your neighbor too. Your neighbor comes out of politeness, but are they getting the same amount of happiness after seeing your child after a year? No. It doesn't really matter to them, because they're not attached. When their child comes home, then they'll feel happy. Even though their child may be less beautiful than your child, their child may be less qualified, less intelligent than your child. They might have gotten all C's at college their first year, and your child brought home all A's. So perhaps in every way you would say that they're, if you were measuring them, they're less than your child. Yet your neighbor gets more happiness from his child than your child. Why? Because he's attached to his child, not to your child. So the happiness of this world is not based in fact. It's not a substantially existing thing. The happiness of this world is based on our thinking, and it requires the attachment of our mind to something. So Shri Krishna is indicating this when he's discussing the unstable and temporary nature of this world. So he's saying you need to look beyond the world for happiness. You need to look to God. I think we need the lights turned on. It's getting a little dark. So, in addition to this, in this chapter, Sri Krishna tells what is beyond Maya. You might be wondering, okay, so let's say I go beyond Maya. I become gunatit, beyond the three qualities of Maya. What's beyond that? Shri Krishna says, Maya bodh is beyond that. Na tadbhasayate suryo na shashanko na pavakah yad gatva na nivartante taddham paramam mam. My param dham, my supreme divine abode, is beyond this material world. When this world is dissolved, what's left? God's divine abode. You see, just like God has a form, so the expansion of His own personality, the expansion of His own form, is His abode. He and His abode are not separate. They're one and the same. His abode is Him, and both are omnipresent. So God in all of His forms is omnipresent. Meaning, Krishna is everywhere. But the same Krishna in the form of Shiva is everywhere. The same Krishna in the form of Ram is omnipresent. The same Krishna in the form of Vishnu, Durga, and even Nirakar Brahma, formless God, is omnipresent. So He simultaneously exists omnipresently in uncountable forms. And along with His forms, His abode is also omnipresent. So that's how a saint, meaning a soul who surrenders to God, depending on what form he surrendered to, then he visualizes that form of God, or he has the divine vision of that form of God. Having received God's grace, he gets divine eyes, divine mind, so he gets, then he sees God's divine form, and he practically sees that God is everywhere. But he doesn't see all the forms of God everywhere, he sees that form of God, whom he worshipped and surrendered to. And that form of God also has an abode. Every form of God has their divine abode, where they reside, and where those souls who attain them also reside. What is that divine abode like? He says, natad bhasayate suryo na shashanko na pavakah. He's talking about the light, because normally if whatever world you live in, you need some light to see something, right? You want to see what this world is like, you need some light. You need some light from the sun, or if the sun isn't there, you need light from the moon, or the stars, or fire, or electricity. Something has to enlighten the world, then you can see what it's like. He says, my divine world is not enlightened by the material sun, or moon, or stars, or fire, because they can't reach over there. Those are all mayic things. Nothing mayic can enter the divine world. Then how is it illuminated? It's self-illuminated. Could there be a sun over there? Sure, there could be sun, moon, stars, but they're all Krishna Himself in the form of that. It's all just the expansion of Krishna's own self. In addition to that, things have their own divine effulgence. The gems that are all over the ground in the divine world, they're not like the gems of our world, which can't be seen in the darkness. If you have a ruby or an emerald or a sapphire or a diamond or gold, they have a very tiny bit of glow to them, but not enough to enlighten a dark room and not enough to be seen in the dark. But over there in the divine world, they glow. They themselves are enough to enlighten that divine world. The matter itself glows, the divine effulgence. And everything is the form of bliss, because Krishna is Satchit Anand, and His abode is the expansion of His own self. So His abode is Satchit Anand. In other words, it itself is the form of bliss. So if you're looking at a flower in the divine world, it's the same blissful experience as looking at Krishna Himself. If you're admiring the moon in the divine world. It's the same bliss you're going to receive as seeing Krishna himself, because he and his abode are one and the same. And he says, yad gatva nanivartante. Those souls who reach over there, they don't ever have to come back into this world under Maya. But we're so attached in this world, when we hear that, we get worried. But could I come back if I wanted to? Sure, no problem. Once you become God realized, you can stay here forever if you want. You can forever be born, keep getting born again and again on this earth. Except you won't be under Maya. You can keep living on this earth, but you won't be bound by the three gunas of Maya. You'll have a divine mind, and you'll be absorbed in the divine bliss. You can keep wandering the earth if you would like to, or you can just stay in the divine world. When this whole universe is dissolved, then you'll have to go to the divine world. When it's again created, then you can come back again. But saints always remain established in their divine state, whether they're in the divine world or whether they're in this material world. Just like God, when he visits here, he's still established in his absolute divine state. He doesn't become material just because he visits this world. Then Sri Krishna tells us about our relationship with him. This is all to explain to us why we should desire him. Mama ivansho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana shashtha mana shashtha nindriyani prakritisthani karshati. He says every soul is my ansh, and every soul has a mind and senses that stay with it. And even when it leaves its body, when the soul leaves the current body it's in, just like the wind picks up the fragrance of the flowers when it blows and carries the scent with it, in the same way the soul takes its material mind and senses with it and then reincarnates. So the same mind and senses stay with you in every birth. That's how your personality is maintained from birth to birth. All your karma is even stored in your mind. Your samskaras are stored there. So that's why people are born with a certain nature, a certain inborn characteristics, because they developed them in their previous lifetimes. So wherever they were when they left their last body, whatever was their mental state, in the same way they begin in the next life. So we've had the same mind since eternity. So the bondage is eternal. Our mayic bondage is eternal. Our mind is part of that bondage. But using that material mind, if we surrender that mind to Krishna, he graces us and we receive a divine mind. Or his grace fully impregnates our mind and divinizes it. So even then, you still get to keep your personality. That's something else people worry about. That when I become God realized, it must mean my mayic mind and senses and body would have to be eliminated, right? You can't enter the divine world with anything mayic. So it means leave your mayic body, leave your mayic senses, leave your mayic mind. Then it means my personality is finished. And how will I experience anything in the divine world? Well, you get a divine mind, divine senses, and divine body. Made of the same substance God, his mind, his body is made of. He gives you that. He graces you with that. We have to love him and surrender our mind to him. By doing that, our mind gets purified. And when it's fully purified, then we're able to receive his divine grace fully, that ultimate grace. And that divinizes our entire personality. So from that moment, even while you stay in this world, you visualize God You can see him and experience him from that instant forth. And then when you leave your material body, you go to the divine world and you get a divine body. And you stay there with your divine mind and body, and that's how you experience God, through those divine faculties. So Shri Krishna is saying, every soul is my eternal Ansh. We're eternally related to him, but in what way? What is he saying, really, that we're his Ansh? Because Ansh means, if you just translate it directly into English, it means a part of or a fraction of. Ansh means a small part of. So does that mean that God was broken into pieces and that's how the souls were created? If we're a part of him or a fraction of him, then what fraction? Are we 1/16th of God? 1/100th of God? 1/1,000,000th of God? And if so, then how and when was God broken into all these pieces? No. Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate. Ishavasya Upanishad says, God can never be broken into pieces. God is always whole and complete. So Krishna must be indicating something else. I mean, this word Ansh is used in all the scriptures describing the relationship between God and the souls. Chinmatram Shri Hare Ransham Sukshmam Aksharam Avyayam. Ved uses the same word, Ansh. Soul is an Ansh of God. Brahma Sutra says, Ansho Nana Vyapadeshat. The souls, all the souls in existence, they're all individual Ansh of God. Ramayana also says, Ishvara Ansh Jiva Avinashi Chetana Amal Sahaj Sukharashi. We're Ansh of Bhagavan. So what does this word Ansh mean? To understand that, again, think about the three things that exist. Maya, the souls, and God. So the souls actually are unlimited in number, and they all belong to Krishna's Jeev Shakti. It's a power of Krishna. Just like Maya Shakti is a power of Krishna. That's the material power that he uses to manifest this world. Could the souls be a part of that Maya Shakti? No. Because Maya is jar, I was explaining, it's mindless, lifeless energy. So obviously we're not mindless and lifeless, so we can't be Ansh of Maya. Are we a direct Ansh of God? No, that would be called Swansh. You know who's Swansh of Shri Krishna? Sa Eko Narayana. In Ved, it says, Sa ek eveshwara narayano khila brahmandadhipati rekonsha. Radhika Upanishad, part of Atharva Ved, is saying that Shri Krishna is so great that his almighty power, Mahavishnu, who creates this entire universe, containing unlimited earth planets, unlimited Brahman planetary systems. That Mahavishnu is only one Ansh of Shri Krishna, one small fraction of his total power, one part of his personality. So that Mahavishnu is a direct Ansh of Krishna. In other words, he is Krishna himself, but Krishna only revealing a small part of who he is, just his almightiness. If he's only revealing his almightiness, he is appearing as Vishnu. So Vishnu is said to be his Swansh, because Krishna himself is Vishnu. There's no difference between the two. It's just a matter of what's being outwardly revealed or manifested. So are souls like that? Are we direct ancha of God? No. Because then we would also have unlimited power, unlimited knowledge, unlimited bliss, which we don't. So we are not ancha of Maya. We're not ancha of God's personal power. We're not swanch. So we're called vibhinnanch. Vibhinna means separate. We're not directly part of God's personality. We exist as separate individual souls. So we belong to Jeevashakti. Jeevashakti vishishtasyaiva tava jeevamsha natu shuddhasya. Jeev Goswami says in his Shat Sandarbh, in Paramatma Sandarbh, he says that Jeev, the souls, they're called Ansh of God because they're a part of his Jeev Shakti. So since Jeev Shakti, the soul power, is God's power and he gives life to all those souls, so they're said to be his Ansh, but more correctly you would say they're Ansh of his Jeev Shakti. Each one of us is like, you think of us as a marble, and you make a whole mountain of marbles. Bring all the souls in existence together into one pile. That's the Jeev Shakti. So we're just one part of his Jeev Shakti. Thus we're called his Ansh. But we're eternally related to him, because he's eternally giving life to every single soul. We're eternally a part of his Jeev Shakti. So he says, all the souls are eternally my Ansh. This is important to understand on several levels, in several different ways. First of all, it's important to understand we are not Swansh. If we were, you wouldn't need to be here right now. Some people say, but if we're a part of God, then why do we have to attain God? God is already within me. Why do I have to attain him? Yes, that's fine to say. It's an intellectual truth. It's a fact that God is within you. But if you're not experiencing it, then it's not enough just to know it intellectually. We have to actually experience God. So, this has to be understood. Otherwise, why would a person even try to follow the path to attain God? We wouldn't. We'd just think, oh, I'm already a part of God, so what does it matter? No, it does matter. Just intellectually knowing that you're a part of God is not enough. You've got to try to attain him and experience him. If you were God, then why would you have to attain yourself? You don't have to attain yourself. You're an individual soul who is existing separate from God. Although God is omnipresent, so he is enveloping you, and he's within you, yet you're not experiencing that, because you're a soul, and he is Supreme God. So that we have to understand. That's one of the reasons, that's a reason we have to attain God. And also understanding our relationship to him explains our desire for him. Because we are his Ansh, we naturally desire for him. See, in this world, we have a few examples of that kind of thing. Let's say you grabbed in your hand a clump of dirt from the earth. You could say that's like an Ansh, and the earth is the Anshi. Anshi means, so this is the part, and this is the whole to which it belongs. Anshi is what the Ansh is from. So let's say you're holding this Ansh of the earth in your hand. It's separate. But why is it separate? Only because you're holding it separate. So release your grip, it automatically falls to the earth. It's pulled to the earth. So there's a natural attraction between Ansh and Anshi. Or you can say there's a natural love. The Ansh has a natural love for his Anshi. So since we are Ansh of God, our soul automatically desires God. You know how every substance has inborn characteristics? So our soul has this inborn characteristic, that it desires God. We automatically love God and want God. And since God is perfect happiness, you can say we automatically desire happiness. And that's the origin of all of our desires. Why do we desire happiness? Because we desire God, and He is happiness. So our soul wants God, or you can say our soul wants happiness. And that nature of the soul is transmitted into our material mind. But then our material mind doesn't understand how to interpret it. Our mind on its own doesn't know anything about the soul, doesn't know anything about God. Our mind is material. So we need the Gita and other such scriptures to educate us. Oh, mind, material mind, you yourself can't know anything about God or about the soul, and you've never experienced it, but you can. So you have to do bhakti to Sri Krishna, then you can experience Him. The mind can understand this much, that it wants happiness. That much it knows. But where is that happiness? What is the nature of that happiness? It doesn't know. It doesn't know where to look. So see, the Gita tells us, what do you want? You want God, who is unlimited, perfect happiness. So this all has to be understood. It's our nature. We automatically desire God. Even an atheist desires God. You might say, no, I don't. Well, do you desire happiness? He'll say, yes. Well, according to my definition, happiness is the same as God. So saying you desire happiness, but you don't desire God, is like saying, I don't believe in my father, but I believe in my mother's husband. I don't believe in God, but I desire happiness. No, God and happiness are two words for the very same thing. This is the knowledge of the Gita. It has to be heard, understood, but we don't stop there. You all heard it and you all understood it. The next step is doing manan or chintan of that knowledge. Because our mind is so conditioned to enjoying this world, and it's so attached in the world, so it's just, it will go back to its old habits. It will go back to trying to find happiness in the world. Even though it's failed to do so uncountable times, and when Gita tells us that, we say, oh yes, yeah, that much I know from my own experience, that's correct. So then where is happiness? It's in God. Oh, okay, I don't know that from my own experience, but I can take your word for it. Since I know through my experience there's no happiness in this world, where do I have left to look? There are three things that exist. Maya, God, and the souls. So the soul is seeking happiness. It has two areas to search in: the world or God. You have two people standing before you. You know one of them is named Dinesh. You're trying to find Dinesh. And there's two people in front of you. So you ask the first one, is your name Dinesh? No, my name is Ramesh. Then you don't even have to ask the second one. You know if he's Ramesh, he must be Dinesh. You know that happiness is not in this world? Then it has to be in God. It's a logical conclusion. So we can accept that. It's a intelligent faith. It's not a blind faith, it's intelligent faith, based on logic. Have we seen God for ourselves? No. But we can have an intelligent faith based on the teachings of Gita and what saints have told us, that God exists, and many have experienced Him as unlimited bliss. We can also follow the path of bhakti and experience that same bliss. Or we can choose not to and keep trying to do manthan of chune ka pani, trying to get ghee out of it. That's fine. meaning this world looks like it has happiness, just like lime water looks like milk. It's a white liquid. You can churn milk and you'll get butter out of it. Churn lime water for millions of years, you'll never get butter out of it. Both are white liquids. So it seems like there should be happiness in this world. We have so much hope of that. So keep doing manthan of that chune ka pani. That's your choice. You can. Eventually you say, wait a minute, this is not working. That person churned white liquid and got butter out of it. What am I doing wrong? So eventually we have to accept the teachings of the Gita and the saints and turn towards God. But this happens only when we do manan of such knowledge. We really have to keep that knowledge in our mind, and then when we feel that desire for happiness, we have to direct it in the right place. If every time we feel that inner restlessness, which is natural, it's our mind that feels from the soul is saying find happiness, and our mind feels that as a kind of restlessness or like an emptiness, like something's missing. That's natural. But if every time when we're realizing that feeling, we turn to the world to try to fulfill that and make that emptiness go away, then we're never going to find the true happiness. There has to be a time where we say, no, I've enjoyed this worldly thing so many times, it's never given me the perfect happiness I desire. Gita is saying I should turn that desire towards Shri Krishna. Let me do that. But that's not a one-time decision. You make that decision thousands of times every day. Because the mind is constantly looking for happiness, and the world is always right there in front of you, so you always have to be thinking, is this what I want? Is this what's going to give me happiness? No, I've experienced this already. Okay, mind, turn towards Krishna. He is unlimited beauty. He is unlimited bliss. If I surrender to Him, if I desire Him, it's the same thing, desire, surrender, same thing, then I'll get perfect happiness. So you have to recondition your own mind. Right now the mind is conditioned to have only hope from this world. We have to recondition it so that it looks for happiness from God. So we have a hope of finding happiness from God. In this way, Shri Krishna tells us the reasons why we have to desire Him. And once we understand these reasons and we really contemplate on them deeply, then we begin the process of turning our mind towards Him. That is the process that happens as you follow the path of bhakti. It's an internal process. You have to keep thinking, keep desiring Krishna. Visualize Him in your mind. Long to attain Him. In the same way that you yearn to enjoy the things of this world, long to get the divine vision of your eternal divine friend and beloved, Shri Krishna. This is the path of bhakti. So we still have one big question remaining, which is that if we're doing this, if we're applying this knowledge of the Gita in our life, then what it means is we're turning all of our desires towards Krishna. All of our attachments are going to develop towards Him, and our attachments in the world are going to reduce. We're going to start experiencing real happiness from Krishna even before God realization. We get a taste of that, which goes on growing. And we'll become less and less interested in the pleasures that the world has to offer us. If that's the case, how will we continue to function in this world? How will we continue to fulfill our responsibilities towards our family, towards the society, our work? All of those things also have to be considered. is our physical life or our worldly life going to deteriorate because our attachment is being transferred from the world towards Krishna? We'll address this topic tomorrow when we finish off the topics of the 15th chapter and also cover the 16th chapter. Uliye Vrindavan Vihari Lala.